welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, and welcome back to Turn the Page, the official podcast of Syosset Library. I'm Jen, your host for today, and I'm here with a couple of very cool scholars who have written a really beautiful book. Could I ask you to introduce yourselves and your book, please?
Sure. I'm Larissa Grolemond. I'm Assistant Curator of Medieval and Renaissance Manuscripts at the J. Paul Getty Museum.
And I'm Brian Keane, Assistant Professor of Art History at Riverside City College and formerly Curator of Manuscripts at the Getty Museum.
And we are the co-authors of The Fantasy of the Middle Ages, An Epic Journey Through Imaginary Medieval Worlds.
Awesome. So first off, I was just telling you before we started that this book is absolutely beautiful, and it is an exhibition catalog which accompanies an exhibit that you both organized at the Getty. Can you tell us a little bit about that exhibit?
Sure. That's The Fantasy of the Middle Ages, so almost the same title. It is an epic journey through imaginary medieval worlds. It is on view at the Getty Center until September 11th, 2022. And this book is really, we sort of think of it as an accompanying publication rather than a strict exhibition catalog. So there's quite a bit of overlap with the objects in the book and in the show. But of course, the gallery presents all sorts of different kinds of challenges with representing the kinds of things that we have in the book. Film stills, for example, video games didn't quite make it into the exhibition. And of course, the gallery space is finite in a way. And so there are about 60 objects on view. A lot from the Getty's permanent collection of manuscripts in dialogue with a whole host of loan objects from California collections, ranging from everything from the UCLA public libraries to the collections of the San Francisco art museums. And of course, some very special loans from the Disney archives and the Disney Animation Research Library kind of round out the lender list.
Nice. That's a really cool collection of, sources for objects. And I'm really interested in the way that you juxtapose them, which you do in the book as well. So about the book, like I said, it's absolutely stunning. It took my breath away when I opened the package that had my advanced copy in it. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what went into the book design process and how it was shaped by the goals of the book and the exhibit.
So one of the things that we really wanted was for the book itself to be a medievalism. The subject of the book and the exhibition is really this long life of the Middle Ages in visual culture, really from the Middle Ages up until today. And the ways in which that has been kind of boiled down to these archetypes. So there are certain characters that we always think of when we think of the Middle Ages, or certain tropes or certain architectural spaces. And we really wanted to bring the feeling of that kind of into the design of the book. So have it really lean into things that maybe we would not want in an exhibition otherwise. So like kind of a font that reads a little bit old English or sort of old book. And then a bunch of kind of graphic nods to this idea of the Middle Ages that has really been distilled over centuries. And so having the book really participate in the construction of these visual medievalisms itself and be a little bit self-referential.
I think something we enjoyed as well was this idea of a choose your own adventure kind of reading. We didn't want the volume to read as a kind of chronological overview of the Middle Ages and the Shakespearean or Victorian era, the Gothic revivals. We really wanted readers to be able to jump around as much as we do as medievalists, or as much as medievalisms themselves within various periods hop around and borrow different aspects of the Middle Ages. So if you're reading through and you're not interested in hearing about a certain topic, you can quickly move right over into that topic that you're really fascinated about. I think another area that we felt we kind of nerded out working on was the index. We kept going back and forth with, do we call it a Yoda-like hybrid creature? And just the range of subjects covered in that index alone, I think, speaks to the content within the volume It was also really exciting to be able to reread and rewatch a lot of our favorite medievalisms. I know that we certainly enjoyed being able to watch some of the films that we love so much, and then to take our own screenshots that are included as images in the book, or to reach out to friends that might own video games or Magic the Gathering cards and ask, could you take photographs of these objects for the book? And then to hide little details within. Our designer really embraced the medievalism aspect that Larissa spoke about. And I love the point that you reminded us about, Larissa, in our pre-recording chat about if Baz Luhrmann made this book, this is, you know, what we want you to embrace. And so he hid these emojis throughout, the change in typeface that you mentioned, the color treatments, the medievalisms, serious scholarship, and also fun.
Yeah, I mean, we really wanted the book to be a beautiful object because the things that are kind of inside of it range from, I think, and like the exhibition, things that people think of as fine art, medieval manuscripts, the 19th century book arts, illustration that really has formed the background and the kind of foundation for the cinematic and video game medievalisms that maybe we're more familiar with. And so there was this huge range of things. So we wanted to reproduce not just objects from the Getty's permanent collection in beautiful color, but we also wanted to give a lot of airtime and a lot of space to screenshots from A Knight's Tale or screenshots from medieval TikTok or, you know, these kinds of things that are all really a part of the visual world of the contemporary Middle Ages. And so we wanted just to have a ton of images and just be able to reproduce things in kind of their full glory and have things that people maybe would not expect being next to each other in a publication like this really kind of play off of each other.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I love about this book so much is that you can, you know, be looking at a beautiful manuscript page and then you turn the page and yes, you're looking at like Heath Ledger dressed up as a knight, you know, and it's just really, it's fun, but it's also really instructive because you get to see how medieval things and, you know, contemporary depictions of the medieval, you know, overlap or how they speak to each other. Before we get into that, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the difference between the medieval and medievalism for our listeners.
Sure. This is such a fun question, I think, because where is the line? And so the medieval, we're really thinking about the historical period that ranges from about 500 to 1500 all over the world, but medievalism is a phenomena which draws from the aesthetics of the medieval and the literature of the medieval period, but reimagines it in different ways. And so we think of medievalism being everything that references the Middle Ages from about 1500 on, which is a huge category of things. But medievalism is, of course, the word that we have given to this modern discipline that studies these things. And primarily, medievalism has been a literary phenomena. And so one of the things that we wanted to do in the book is really turn our attention to the visual and reconstruct this kind of visual history of medievalism, which really hadn't been done as much. And I think the category of medievalism is sort of always expanding, kind of moves from being books and architecture and things that kind of constitute fine art to things like social media and really kind of digital things that are happening even around us right now.
And I think, Larissa, you're right. To this point of medievalism's being sort of everywhere around the world, we've seen a nice parallel between global medieval studies that attempt to look at that 500 to 1500 period in terms of networks of trade or exchange, but to see the way that global medievalisms are both referencing the European medieval past while combining it with other phenomena from contemporaneous periods. So we've seen an embrace of medieval chivalric tales in manga and anime stories in East Asia, alongside stories about the samurai, or to see the looking again at the Shahnameh in Islamic contemporary art in the same way that artists in the 14th and 15th century in Iran or Iraq were also thinking about their historic tales for the moment in which they were working. So it's this phenomenon that picks up from the very moment that we're starting to study as scholars. I think the point Can we go on record to say again that the greatest medievalism is medieval studies itself, that we are all as scholars attempting to recreate or reimagine or re-understand the Middle Ages, just as those individuals who go to Renaissance Fair are. They're both as serious and as important for study.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the study of medievalism too, something we've said in other venues, and I think is so true and so important to point out, is that medievalism and medievalisms have the power to shape how people see real history. And so the fact that they're so present and sort of so operative in contemporary culture, I think makes them vitally important for study, because they really have a huge impact on the way that we as scholars approach the Middle Ages, but also the way that the general audience kind of thinks of the medieval period.
Yeah, if we drill down on that point, I think it's really important, because we often see the pushback in contemporary thought today that if they see a black elf or a black dwarf, they're all of a sudden upset. Like, well, this is not real about the Middle Ages. Well, are dwarves and dragons and wizards real? I mean, I think there are some that would say yes, right? But if fantasy can encompass anything, a world with dragons and wizards, and why not see people of color in those starring roles? The same way that medieval history reveals accounts of prominent knights of color, women in leadership positions, queer relationships, all the things that we see in contemporary medievalisms were present in the Middle Ages in some capacity. And sometimes it requires us to excavate or unearth those stories. But we really sort of chuckle when we see this attempt to fact check an already fantastical world of the past.
That is, there are many good points in what you both just said, but the ones that I'll address first is this idea of fact checking, and the idea that like studying medievalism is not about fact checking at all. This was something that I encountered. I used to teach a class on film medievalism at Stony Brook when I was doing my degree, and you know, something I told my students who used to write papers about like what, you know, whether the costumes in A Knight's Tale were accurate or not. And I'm like, that's not really the point, you know, and that's almost inaccurate in itself, because like, as you say in your book, like the Middle Ages themselves didn't really care about historical accuracy. Like they were already blending history and fiction, like in their view of themselves. And so what instead, if it's not fact-checking, like what do we get out of studying medievalism?
I think this was one of the central questions for us too, when we were thinking about how are we linking medievalism to the Middle Ages if it's not about uncovering authenticity or accuracy. And it's one of the reasons that we started the book with this chapter called The Medieval Imagination, and really wanted to ground the discussion of medievalism in the approach to storytelling that was part of the Middle Ages and the approach to representing those stories. And so we have this trio of manuscripts, which blends, as you say, kind of history and legend or history and myth already in the construction of the world. And what we're thinking of with these tales, for example, the romance of Gillian de Trazigny, which tells the adventure story of this knight who goes from his home in Western Europe to the Middle East and has all these crazy adventures. It was made in the 15th century. And so the images really ground the viewer in the world of the 15th century, in the courtly spaces of the readers that would have looked at the manuscript. But they do so in this really interesting way that combines elements of quote unquote real medieval costume or real medieval dress with these fantastical ideas of turbans for representing the Middle East, or, you know, these kind of imagined architectural spaces. And so there's already kind of in the imagery and in the storytelling, this hybrid idea of what is real and what is not. And that was totally normal and totally interesting for a medieval audience. And so looking at the way that I think medieval storytelling really embraced the idea of fantasy already in the images and in the stories themselves, that provided us a really interesting, I think, jumping off point or a foundation for thinking about the way that medievalism kind of draws from that. But the way that like scholars are not interested in fact-checking those manuscripts in the way that we're interested in fact-checking Game of Thrones, for example. So like, why is that? Like, is it because it's historical material? So it's like sort of automatically authentic in a way. But we wanted to sort of interrogate that idea, because the I think medievalisms of later centuries, of the post-medieval period, do that same thing, where they take little bits of the quote-unquote real medieval, but combine it with these fantastical things, supernatural happenings or magical creatures, and they wrap it in the kind of visual covering of the Middle Ages. So you get things like castles and swoopy sleeves and all of these things which are visual shorthand for the Middle Ages, but which are recombined and retold in all of these really interesting ways. And so the legacy of that is that we get little bits of reality or historical accuracy, but that's not the point, right? So medievalisms and medieval inspired stories always tell us more about the culture in which they're created than the Middle Ages themselves.
Yeah, something that I really found fascinating in the book that relates to that is, you know, the fact that the Middle Ages, or, you know, artists and writers of the Middle Ages were engaged with this with their own past too. Like, you bring up the example of a manuscript that shows images of the life of Alexander the Great, right? And it's set like in the present of the manuscript's production, not like in ancient times. And this is similar to what, like, Larissa, what you and I saw when we studied in Florence, the way that like Renaissance artists, you know, depicted the Virgin and child in Renaissance Italy, not in Jerusalem in the first century, you know. And so what do you think like is drives that urge, either for like the medieval folks who were doing that with their own, like, do we want to call it classicalism, you know, or like with, you know, other historical periods looking back at the Middle Ages?
There's this really interesting thing that's nostalgic always about the past and looking back to the past as a simpler time, or a time where the ideals of that period are worthy of revival. And I think that is something that motivates the revival of certain medieval aesthetics too. I mean, we see that in the 19th century with the Victorians and with the Pre-Raphaelites especially. They're aiming through their artistic production to revive the ideals of the Middle Ages. And it is motivated by this really kind of romantic view of the period, which is simplified and of course streamlined for 19th century consumption. And I think that that's happening already in the Middle Ages too. I mean, there are jousts and tournaments from the 15th and 16th centuries, which are deeply nostalgic for a time already gone by. We would think of that as, oh, this is the medieval practice of jousting, but really it's an attempt to maintain and revive these kinds of courtly ideals, which are really shaping aristocratic identity and just forming the kind of class identity and cultural identity of these people who are sort of so deeply invested in preserving that history. But it's already several hundred years later, like already thinking about people in the 15th century looking back to the 12th century, it's sort of ongoing. And I think that is really, I think, informative to think about, because they're as far removed from the 12th century as we are from the 16th century. There's already so much time that has passed that it allows this kind of romanticization and nostalgia for a period which is sort of unrecoverable in a way.
And I think to that point, Larissa, we've talked a lot about which medieval or which medievalism authors or creatives are thinking about. And so for someone like George R.R. Martin, we can look at Game of Thrones and say, yes, it does reflect some of the realities of the War of the Roses with this Eastern Byzantine Empire on the horizon. But because Martin's own ignorance about the kingdoms in Africa, we then don't see great Black rulers in the show. And that was really criticized. On the flip side, you see something like Marvel's Black Panther that does celebrate that medieval legend of the Epic of Sunjata. And you see the wealth of Mansa Musa and his technology translated into the figures of the Black Panther court. So it really, I think, begs the question of whose medievalism are we thinking about? And to your point, Jen, about Alexander, I mean, the author didn't mince words about the fact that he was going to update this tale for his modern readers. Same gendered relationships, no more. Let's just regender all of our, you know, queer couplings so that it avoids a bad example, as he tells us. And then we'll end with a prayer to the Christian God and amen. And this is the vraie histoire d'Alexandre le Grand, the true history of Alexander the Great. And yet all along, we've been told all the things that are not true and all the ways that they've updated the reading for the present. And that's, after all, what we have always done, whether as scholars or as creative medievalists.
I wonder if, you know, because I've spent a lot of time thinking about like the sort of medieval relationship to truth and what their concept of truth was as compared to ours. And like with a lot of that, like with this new correct Alexander, it almost makes me think of like Stephen Colbert's truthiness, you know, like it's not quite truth, but it feels true. And that's kind of what's important, you know?
I think that's so funny too, because there are so many contemporary medievalisms, which are like aiming to get back to this idea of greater accuracy or more true. And I'm thinking especially of the trend in Arthur stories, where we got these like very romantic 90s versions of the King Arthur story. The First Knight with Sean Connery is like the one that is really sticking in my head. But then like in the early 2000s, we got King Arthur with Keira Knightley and Clive Owen, which aimed to be this like recovery of the real King Arthur, or the story of the true King Arthur. And so you get this like move from these various very stereotypical medieval spaces of First Knight that are like 14th and 15th century Gothic architecture, and they're taking place in France and England, like many of the kind of book-based stories that they draw from. But then with King Arthur, you get this sort of gritty King Arthur, and it's set amid the fall of the Roman Empire, and it's supposed to be more sort of historically accurate in a way. But of course, it just is creating all of these new fictions and layering that onto the previous examples that have come before it. But there's this sense of wanting to get back to something that feels accurate, or which is accurate, but really is what you're saying about truthiness. It just feels authentic enough. And that's what we want from these things. But I think it's sort of fascinating to think about why we want to retell these stories all of the time in different ways, and the kind of cultural motivations behind those, that drive. Because like, what about the early 2000s made us really want a historical King Arthur? I don't know. Maybe we didn't. That's why that movie didn't do very well. But, you know, there's another King Arthur that I read about, which is being directed by Zack Snyder, which is the same thing. It's supposed to be the historical King Arthur, or I don't know, some sort of new retelling, which aims to be more true than previous versions, which is of course crazy, but I like that we're still trying to do that. It just, it is, there's something about the culture that we live in, I think, that wants that kind of excavation and isn't satisfied with the more romantic versions. But there's something about, yeah, being true enough or feeling authentic enough to pass for real. And I think that that's a really interesting thing about contemporary medievalism.
You know, that was like such an interesting, weird trend in the early aughts. And I feel like we're kind of getting out of it now, maybe, because, you know, more recently we've had The Green Knight with Dev Patel, which is like, I thought was like fantastic. And yeah, so with The Green Knight, like, I'm really excited to see like where Arthurian adaptations are headed, because, you know, The Green Knight seems to be finally making a departure from this, like, let's make it gritty and real, into like, let's acknowledge that this is a fantasy about magic girdles and green people, you know, and like, so.
Yeah, in some ways I felt like The Green Knight was so true to the original medieval source material in the kind of pacing and the kind of vignette experience of it, and that it was really kind of lingering on the aesthetics and really exploring the mental state of, you know, the journey. And there wasn't a lot of action adventure or even a linear plot for for the most part, but it was really concentrated on these like very saturated visual moments and the weirdness of it, which is very true to the original literature. And it was sort of interesting to see that translated to film, because there had been such a pushback against Dev Patel in the title role, which of course is crazy because he's British and why not? It doesn't make any sense for him not to be in the title role. And he was great. But we saw, you know, cameos from King Arthur and some of the rest of the round table. And so it's so interesting to see those kind of updated visual iterations of these characters, which we have come to know so well from all of these other versions of them. And yeah, it did feel so modern in a way, but then also really true to the medieval source material in a lot of other ways.
And we also, I mean, we laughed at the reaction, not just to Dev Patel's casting, but we predicted that there would be huge outrage about the scene with Lord Bertilac, that people would see this as a kind of identity politics, appealing to LGBTQ communities. And I just remember laughing that if people read the text, I think the film short-sighted the LGBTQ community. We could have had a much more, you know, queer, you know, forward narrative with that kiss that Lord Bertilac gives to Dev Patel's character. I mean, it would have been so much more wonderful to really lean into the actual medieval text, but I'm grateful we got even that. So it's a sort of hilarious task to try to fact check or correct, but there's that constant feeling that the medieval has to still be straight, cis, and white, and yet we know that, of course, it wasn't.
That's itself really a 19th century creation, this idea of the interpretation of the Middle Ages as being heteronormative, kind of whitewashed, really plays into these romantic ideas of the 19th century and the revival of chivalry, especially the correct conduct of men and women and these really kind of narrow gender roles. And so the medievalism or the medieval that we have inherited today is really so dependent on that 19th century moment, but there's so many before that too. So we really think of the 19th century as being a recipient of all of these both medieval and post-medieval things, totally repackage it and present it as this medieval revival of, you know, authentic medieval ideals and spirit. And that's the thing I think that we have received most of and most strongly in our kind of contemporary retellings of the medieval world, which feels very restrained and kind of limited in a way.
And it's that constant resistance to the 19th century. I mean, if anything, we're having to reconstruct the Middle Ages from that, right? From our racist heritage, sexist, homophobic, transphobic heritage. So it's the heritage that never really was in the past that we're trying to recover in some ways.
Yeah, it's almost ironic that, you know, because I think it's good time for us now to talk about the sort of like the more insidious, you know, the dark underbelly of medievalism that we've been talking about here, that, you know, this sort of white supremacist or, you know, transphobic and homophobic urge to depict this very heteronormative white Middle Ages makes claims to, you know, historicity, but actually is like, you know, compressing all of history and painting it as very monolithic, which it is not, you know. And one of the things that I really admired about the book is that you cite the work of a lot of medievalists of color and especially women of color who've been doing really, really important work lately to fight back a lot of these appropriations of the medieval.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, white supremacists have tried to appropriate the symbols and history of the medieval period for their own nefarious ends. And this has happened, I think, in a lot of venues. Almost every topic that we touched had some element of this in it. And of course, the white supremacist vision of the medieval is itself a fiction, as many medievalisms are, but this one has been kind of co-opted and transformed in a way that I don't even think people from the medieval period would recognize. And so one of the things that we really wanted to do was present medievalism as both a symptom of this problem, but also a solution to it. Because if we can create more inclusive and equitable fantasy worlds, as I was saying in the beginning, that has the power to then shape the way that we think about doing history and writing history. And so, as you mentioned, there's been a lot of really important work recently in the realm of medieval studies, which kind of pulls back the curtain on a lot of these misuses of the medieval, especially by white supremacist groups. And I think that we have to see all of these things in tandem and see the work of medievalism, not just as as fun and sort of culturally benign in a way, but really implicated in the cultural moment that we're in right now, and try to push back against the misuses of these histories and kind of refocus it on something which feels more productive and advances the work of inclusivity and creating a more equitable field for scholars, but also creating a vision of the Middle Ages as a historical period, which dispels these myths of white supremacy.
And I think one of the authors that we thought about really early on, Jen, to your question, was Maria Sashiko Sasiri, who asked the question, you know, whose Middle Ages are we talking about when medievalists at conferences reflect on, we all loved growing up reading C.S. Lewis or J.R. Tolkien or Harry Potter, because we may not include all medievalists, especially not medievalists of color or certain queer and trans folk. And so then the work of, you know, people like Sierra Lomuto and Dorothy Kim and Mary Rambram Olm remind us constantly to ask and to interrogate our own positionality, which is, I think, something that Larissa and I tried to think a lot about as we wrote the book, and to be as inclusive as possible about the global reach of these medievalisms, and to think not just about the European Middle Ages as a product of medievalism broadly writ, but to also recognize the important privilege that white or white passing folk have to do this work, to speak out against the co-option by white supremacists, and that you really can't just embrace Tolkien or Disney or Harry Potter without addressing those concerns. I know there was a point at one stage in the discussion of the book, did we need to take a harder stand about J.K. Rowling's stance, anti-trans stance? And we realized, well, actually, we would need to interrogate every single medievalist author, from racism in Tolkien to sexism and homophobia in George R.R. Martin to the transphobia in J.K. Rowling. Everyone is sort of part of that process, either for good or otherwise, in the making of medievalisms.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think, like, you know, a lot of this conversation has had me thinking that, like, throughout post-medieval time, like, the Middle Ages has sort of been like a mirror that we've held up to ourselves, that we hope to see ourselves in, and sometimes that we hope not to see ourselves in, you know. But I think that, like, you're absolutely correct that, you know, there is this, you know, white supremacist, homophobic, transphobic view of the Middle Ages that has really wanted to be like the dominant view for a really long time. And it's great that there are now different images of that Middle Ages that are speaking to a more, you know, accurate vision of the medieval world, and that it's all wrapped up in activism today, you know, like, just as with medievalism and the medieval, it's hard to draw boundaries between like history and activism and all of these different things.
Yeah. I think one thing that was so important for us was really to make the boundary between medieval and medievalism a little fuzzier in a way. Like, we were aiming to recover some forgotten histories of the Middle Ages by pointing out that there are female knights or female warriors or people of color who are just as present in the medieval world, but that to also point out that fantasy has been so powerful in the construction an erasure of those histories. And the vision of the Middle Ages that we have is such a product of medievalism versus historical research. And I think we as scholars are also really affected by that. I mean, we come to the Middle Ages via fiction much of the time. And to pretend that we are not affected by those visions of the Middle Ages, which are told to us from childhood, is silly. I mean, we have to really, I think, grapple with the legacy of medievalism that we've received as scholars and how that influences our own research. Of course, we would like to pretend that, of course, I don't watch Harry Potter. Of course, I don't watch Game of Thrones. That is beneath me as a medieval scholar, but of course it is not. And to pretend that those are not part of the field, I think, is deluding ourselves in a way. And so really kind of grappling with the history of those fantasy worlds in our scholarship, like, that was something that we talked a lot about when we were writing the book.
I think it's also, it comes off as somewhat arrogant to me when scholars scoff at those interests. You know, scholars that will say, I have to now teach Game of Thrones when I teach the Middle Ages, or I have to, you know, address Harry Potter, rather than seeing it as a real opportunity, not a gateway or not a pipeline issue. Like, these are real ways that people are thinking about and getting excited about the past. I mean, I think we, as medievalists, I remember going to so many conferences, whether Kalamazoo or Leeds, and everyone wants to scoff at the Society for Creative Anachronism until you actually need to know how a crossbow works or how an astrolabe works or how to make a pewter pilgrim badge. And then they all come out in droves to make these little tokens of the Middle Ages. But of course, they don't want to be seen as part of the, you know, the SCA or as LARPers. And yet, I really loathe that kind of divide, because I think, Larissa, you and I, we learned so much from the social media engagement, right? When people were asking questions about the Game of Thrones, could you really transport elephants on a ship? And sure enough, we had images in the Getty collection of elephants being transported on ships. So the questions and the concerns and the interests that people have in the Middle Ages are relevant. And I think as curators and academics, if we can step away from the gatekeeping mindset, and like you said, Larissa, embrace the fact that many of us come to these fields from places of fiction, rather than, you know, I've not met a medievalist who says, you know, it was that fourth grade textbook in European history that really made me a medievalist. No, it was the opening credits of Disney Sleeping Beauty, or it was that video game, Legend of Zelda, or whatever, right? So well done. That's huzzah, the best point I've heard all day.
Well, it's really fascinating too, because I think something we learned when we were doing the Getty of Thrones, the Game of Thrones initiative, was that people were asking really sophisticated questions about historical material. And I think that gave us a real window into what people know about the Middle Ages and what has been shaped by these more fictional worlds. And it is really a blend. There's such a mix, I think, of kind of received knowledge about the Middle Ages, which is equal parts shaped by real history and sort of real historical research, and these more fictional kind of fantastical elements. But, you know, we come to this stuff really early. And I think, you know, there's a book in the book and in the exhibition, which is a Grimm edition from the early 20th century, which has these wonderful illustrations by Arthur Rackham. And when I was looking for Grimm editions that had these really wonderful illustrations, that one popped out to me and I was like, oh my gosh, I had this as a kid. Like, there was some book that reproduced these Rackham illustrations. I didn't remember the stories at all, but the illustrations had such a powerful influence on my memory that it sort of made me think, like, well, these are the things that stay with us. It's these visual impressions of the Middle Ages that we see from a really early age, and which become, I think, part of the way we think about this period in these really kind of difficult to separate ways from our, you know, how we do research as scholars and how we think about primary sources and what we assume to be true. I think that kind of, it's nebulous and it's really hard to pin down, but that kind of sense is so powerful, I think, for us in the field, that was something we wanted to bring out in the book too, was really that nostalgia for the things that we encountered as children, which have had such a powerful role in shaping our view of the Middle Ages. But then to, as Brian said, kind of widen that scope and really contextualize that material within these global medievalisms and think about this as a really kind of complete phenomena that happens over, you know, continents and centuries. And one thing about the exhibition that I think is really fantastic is that we have a section of the exhibition that's actually been donated by Getty staff. So it's what we've come to call medieval ephemera, and it's really objects of pop culture that are seen within this atrium space, kind of between the galleries of the exhibition. And there's everything in this section. It's sort of like board games and Barbies and Beanie Babies and movies and books and all of these things, which are ways that the Middle Ages really still lives in popular culture. And to see that stuff in continuum, in context with the fine art material in the galleries, I think that's really powerful, because the Middle Ages exists on all of these different registers. It's not just a thing that happens in fine art or a thing that happens in book illustration. It's happening all around us. And so we can't sort of separate it out into these these worlds and draw these really clear boundaries between them, because we may be as influenced by something like Morgan Le Fay Barbie as we are, you know, a movie that also has that character in it.
And no offense to the castle scholars out there, but Stephen Beastie's Cutaway Castles is still the best source in my mind about what castle life was actually like. Despite all the castles I visited, I still have that Cutaway Castle book on my shelf and turn to it frequently. So, you know, I'm willing to admit that.
Yeah, I think those initial ways in which we encounter medieval history or the medieval do have these like really deep resonances, you know, and they can lead you into the field. And it is really exciting to see scholars embracing that rather than, as you say, gatekeeping and trying to keep the field like serious or, you know, like any number of adjectives you could apply there. Because my entryway into studying medieval history was Monty Python. And then when I learned that one of the members of Monty Python was actually a medieval scholar, that really, you know, grabbed my interest and I wanted to know more. And it was part of me consuming Monty Python as a fan, but also sort of becoming a medieval historian at the same time.
I think that's such a fun way in. And I feel like we all have medievalist origin stories in that way. I mean, I think mine was going to the Renaissance Fair as a child. There was this Renaissance Fair in Bristol, Wisconsin, which was close to where I grew up in Northern Illinois. And that kind of immersive experience and the costuming and the joust and the food, of course, it's not accurate, but like the idea that that world was so real and so present at a place like that, I think was really influential on my imagination and really, I think, influenced the way that I think about the Middle Ages, or I thought about the Middle Ages, the way I still think about the Middle Ages in some ways. But that kind of the theatricality of those spaces and reenactment is something that we talked about in the book and which made it into the show kind of in the form of jousting. And objects that have to do with jousting. But I think the Middle Ages is really particular because it's a period that people still want to experience physically and have that kind of sense of it being real around them. And I think that's really unique to the period. I've been saying to people, you know, we don't have ancient Greek world or like Victorian land. Yeah. Not that I don't think those would be super fun because I would totally go to those places, but there seems to be something about the Middle Ages which makes it really flexible in the modern period for reenactment. Mm-hmm. And I think that was something that came from the book arts and came from this really long legacy of things. And so like sort of tracing reenactments, visual history was also really a part of this project that I found really, really fun.
Yeah, there's sort of no equivalent. I mean, you have the toga party, which is fun for, you know, getting drunk and putting on a bed sheet, but it's not the same. It's a sort of costume drama compared to the real attempt at authenticity or experiential engagement that you've just mentioned, that sort of multi-sensorial engagement of the medieval.
Which, I mean, I think we found was really connected to photography in the 19th century and the practice of tableau vivant and kind of reenacting these stories with real people dressed in costume for this really new medium, which sets the stage for cinematic medievalism, but then kind of creates this period which feels reenactable in a way. Like there's a accessibility about the Middle Ages that I think is part of its history, which makes it both attractive and doable in the contemporary period. We think we know so much about the Middle Ages that it's easy to reenact in a way, and you don't actually need much foreknowledge to go to a Renaissance fair and feel like you're really participating, because there's so much that you've already consumed, maybe passively, about the Middle Ages that you feel sort of prepared to be there, which I find so interesting and really particular about the period.
And it's fascinating that people instantly either pick up the castle speak or are just part of the, you know, the plebs who just can't hack it. But then you'll see a stormtrooper walking by and a Jedi Knight and a pirate, and it all just works because they've all
been.
But
the pirate is also speaking castle speak. Like the pirate is also like huzzahing and, you know, that kind of thing. But it's like this, it's such a crazy amalgamation of periods and influences. But there's something about the medieval which makes it a really comfortable home for all of those things at the same time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's super interesting to me how, you know, it speaks to sort of a, you know, when we are like immersing ourselves in these medieval fantasies, we are like accessing history and, you know, perhaps in some cases like a shared history or like a national identity or an ethnic identity or whatever have you. But also like it's really deeply linked to, like, as you were talking about, like childhood memories and personal identity. So it speaks to all of these like kind of group identities and individual identities in super interesting ways that I think makes it like kind of universally attractive across time, you know?
It's so funny to me that the Middle Ages is like a shorthand for nerd culture. There's like this really interesting thing that's happened. I think must have been relatively recently. I would say probably within the last 20 or 25 years, which is like the Middle Ages and places like Renaissance fairs are like coded nerdy. And so they've become a home for everything nerdy. And I love that for the Middle Ages. Like, I just want that to be part of its story. And I think there's a really fascinating thing about Renaissance fairs and places like that, which equally welcome fairies and these kind of magical creatures, people dressed up as, you know, any kind of thing that isn't real, but which fits into the idea of the Middle Ages and is equally home to steampunk and pirates and stormtroopers. And I mean, so many Renaissance fairs have these theme weekends now, which are not medieval at all. But like the fact that that happens at a medieval coded space, I feel it is such an interesting kind of recent development for medievalism and for reenactment more generally.
I mean, I was here for it, Larissa, as you know, when we saw the Renaissance Fair locally had an Avengers or a Marvel themed weekend. And it's like, of course, Iron Man is just a knight and the Black Widow is just an assassin for hire. Of course, it makes sense. You can see it all existing in the same space. And by the way, get ready for, you know, Jedi weekend next week or something. It makes sense, but it appeals, as you say, to that nerd culture. Maybe we could push it back even further to the sort of punk rock days of sort of album covers with medievalizing themes. I mean, there was a time when it did appear to, in some cases, these subgroups that are now mainstream. I mean, I'd like to think that we were always, you know, mainstream as nerd culture, but it's taken a little while. Maybe we needed to get there through all these other accumulations of medievalisms.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, something that delights me is the fact that there is something called medieval TikTok, which is basically Gen Zers taking medieval backgrounds from manuscripts or newly digitized open access collections and doing castle speak in front of them and calling that medieval. Like, I just think that that's a really interesting and fantastic new iteration of medievalism, which, of course, like of course it's online now. Of course it's digital. But it's for a new generation and it's using the tools of this new generation, which I find really fascinating because there's something perennially interesting about this material. And they're relying so much on this layered history of medievalism that we've been talking about. And so they're drawing from the history of the Renaissance fair, which draws from the history of photography, you know, so you can trace medieval TikTok all the way back to the Middle Ages, really. But it's been made easier and sort of facilitated by the presence of medieval images online and the fact that the visual culture of the Middle Ages is so accessible and to a really wide audience of people who are using it for their own ends, and I think in really creative ways.
Well, and the fact that some of the earliest medieval TikToks, weren't they using the bardcore version of Shakira's Hips Don't Lie? And I mean, I would draw everyone to the fact that the Spotify playlist that Kellen Michael created for the show is truly amazing. I mean, my kids and I were laughing at the Hildegard von Bingen version of Holding Out for a Hero. You know, these lines are so clever. You know, a man of whom Chaucer will write. I mean, it just gives hours of fun and brings a huge smile to my face that people are streaming these totally wonderful sort of nerd culture anthems now.
Oh, yeah, it's really great to see. I love medieval TikTok and I really love just seeing how, you know, different communities and different generations all relate to the medieval and how, as you said, like technology has allowed all these new modes of expression. I am so thankful to both of you for making the time to talk to us and our listeners today. Thank you so much for coming. This has been so much fun. I could talk for hours more, but I think I'll give our listeners a break and wrap things up.
Thank you, Jen. This has been so fun. And we hope that people will get the book and see themselves in it and find something that they're interested in it. And of course, if you're in LA or coming to the LA area, stop by the Getty Center to have a look at all of these things which make up the history of medievalism.
Yes, well said. I am dying to make it to LA in time to see this exhibit. But if I don't make it, I will, you know, definitely see whatever amazing stuff that you all put together next time. All right, listeners. So as Larissa said, you can pick up this absolutely beautiful book at your nearest library or independent bookstore as of the airing of this episode. This has been Jen in conversation with Larissa Grolemond and Brian Z. Keen, and it is now time to close this chapter.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.